Barbara Hogarth, and today I'm chatting with Jacinta Halloran, former GP, family therapist, and author of four novels. She has a new book out, which is nominally the occasion for this conversation. The book is called Resistance, and it explores, through a series of seemingly random but intense encounters, the way in which stories, created by us or imposed on us by others, shape our knowledge of ourselves and influence the way in which we see the world. We are, to quote the novel, summed up and made knowable, for to be otherwise is too uncomfortable. The central character, a family therapist, is a lightning rod for the seemingly random but intriguing stories that circulate in the world of the novel. It is perhaps not surprising that a novelist would take this view of meaning-making and selfhood. And today, I want to draw Jacinta out on her story. Hello, Jacinta.
Hello, Barbara.
I could say welcome, but that would be a bit disingenuous because we are sitting in your writing room.
That's right. My very, well, it's quite a tight room, isn't it? We've sort of realised with the equipment on the desk, we're a little bit squishy, but I actually love it as a writing room. It's working really well for me. I think a small room is actually very nice. You feel very, very sort of comfortable and cosy.
Yeah. And there's a nice window with an outlook onto some trees.
Yes.
Jacinta, I feel that you've had a number of significant iterations in your life, GP, family therapist, and the writing, which I suspect has run through all those things. Can you take us back to when you decided to study medicine?
I was probably in my what we called the HSC year in those days, so I would have been about 16, and I had a couple of very sort of feisty feminist friends who were who were keen to do medicine, and I think to a certain extent, I was influenced by that.
Uh-huh.
But I'd always liked, I'd always loved English and I'd loved languages, but I had also liked the sciences. So I was pretty happy to go along with it because I didn't mind that idea of biology and chemistry and those sort of things.
Mm-hmm. And, had you done any writing at that stage? Was that, or you're just interested in literature?
I wasn't a particularly motivated writer when I was young. I didn't keep a diary, really, and I didn't write outside of what I was required to do. But when I was actually set a task for school, mm-hmm. I actually really got into the writing, the creative writing. I didn't actually like writing those sort of what do you call those? It's persuasive essays or whatever that we had to do for English. They were set, but I liked the creative writing. And I did actually love reading. I always loved reading. That was actually my first love. And liked literature, and then I could sort of analyse a book and write about it in that way, in a sort of analytical way, yeah.
Okay. And how did you find the course of medicine? I mean, you said you enjoyed science. Did it deliver in that way as you studied? Did you find it satisfying?
There were elements of it that I found satisfying. I didn't like what we called the preclinical years. It was different in those days. You spent 3 years at uni not seeing any patients, but studying anatomy and physiology. And I didn't really like that. I found that incredibly dry.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a crisis of confidence about that. I didn't really feel that I was particularly good at it, and I didn't think it was right for me.
Okay.
But when I actually got into the hospital, so that was in my fourth year of uni, and started to relate to patients and see how, you know, illness manifests in a person.
Yeah.
I became more interested in it as a mm-hmm. as a profession. It sort of sat better with me then.
So when people entered the frame. Because I know that science is something that you draw on in your writing. And I mean, mm-hmm. science even made its way into the title of your third novel, mm-hmm. Science of Appearances.
Yeah.
But I also think, I mean, medicine obviously is a science, but it is also a science of reading, I think. Has your experience been that you've had to be a good reader of people?
Oh, of people. Okay, so I think so, absolutely. And in fact, in general practice, which is what I did mainly, and certainly in therapy, when I worked in mental health and then in family therapy, reading people is absolutely key.
Mm.
And the other part of that is, when you read a novel, you read the character, but you also read the story. And I think that idea of actually looking at a patient or a client in a therapy sense and thinking, here is someone who's a character, but they have a story as well, and sort of being very engaged with the story and trying to understand what that story means to them is hugely important. It's important in therapy, but it's also important in medicine as well, I think.
It is, although I would say medicine probably doesn't always provide you with the opportunity to get the backstory.
Well, yes, it depends on what you're doing. I think in general practice you probably should get the backstory because your job is to see people over many years usually. So you really need to know, you sort of need to know their story. Mm. But there are lots of other aspects of medicine, lots of other specialties where it's very hard to be aware of someone's sort of whole life and the meaning of their life for them. So, I understand it's horses for courses around that a bit.
Yeah. Yeah. So you worked as a GP for several decades.
Yeah.
And at some point, I'm imagining that the desire to write became too strong for you to ignore. Can you talk about the sort of the threshold moment moving from working solely as a GP to taking steps towards becoming a writer?
Yeah, so I can. I remember I was in my mid-30s perhaps, and I had my children, and I sort of saw that, as women do often when they have their babies, they take time off from work and then they think about going back. And there was a point where I knew I'd had my third child, was my last child, and I knew that there wasn't another time I was going to be on maternity leave. So I was thinking, well, does this mean now that I go back into general practice and I build up to full time again and that's it? And I really thought then that, no, that's not what I want to do. And I really thought, and I'd known for a while that I wanted to write, but it became sort of a very crystallized choice at that point.
Yeah.
I thought, no, I need to go and learn how to write. And that's what I did.
That's so interesting because you describe that as a crystallized choice, but whereas your decision to enter medical studies was more of a, I'm on the wake more of the feisty friends.
Yes.
Is that a reasonable sort of characterization of the two different moments?
Yes, I think so. I think that one was sort of just going with the flow a little bit and not seeing a lot of reasons why I shouldn't do it, but not really feeling clear that was what I should do with my life. I didn't feel clear.
Yeah.
But with writing, I really felt there was a lot at stake because I knew deep down I really wanted to do it.
So you went off to RMIT.
I did, yeah.
And the book that you wrote for that course was published, your first book.
Yes, well, it took a while for me to build up my writing credentials and my confidence, but eventually, yes, I was at RMIT when I started dissection. And that was the book that got published.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And to come full circle, it was a book about being a doctor.
Yeah, yes. To a reasonable extent, those interests in science and the experience of being a doctor, they are the material of your written work. They've they're what you've drawn on, which is completely understandable. And I was wondering too whether the writing in some way was gave you a capacity to process those experiences.
Absolutely. I think all my writing sort of arises from something that I feel I want to understand better.
Mm-hmm.
And writing, although the idea for dissection came to me when I read an article about a GP who'd been sued, and it suddenly dawned on me that I could write a book like that.
Mm-hmm.
But really what I was writing about there was my relationship with general practice and some of my anxieties around being a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And I used some of those anxieties to really fuel my writing for that book. Although I haven't been sued, I put a lot of the anxiety I felt into the character who had been sued. And, it was helpful.
Mm-hmm.
I actually came out of the writing of that book with a clearer understanding of how I as an individual could work as a doctor.
Yeah.
Using my own self,
yeah,
rather than some sort of imagined model of what a doctor should be. I could just be myself in my role as a doctor. And I think it helped me a lot. And I think probably helped my patients too.
So more trust in yourself perhaps?
Well, just sense that the way I would work as a doctor was okay.
Yeah.
I didn't have to conform to some strange model I might have in my head of what a doctor should be.
I think doctors are well represented in the literary world. There's a lot of doctors who become writers, and I feel the nature of the work probably does require a certain amount of processing that perhaps writing is the only real way that you can kind of get in there and do that sort of inner work. Perhaps so.
I think so. I think there's a lot of stuff that happens in medicine that is incredibly rich and complex and lends itself to being written about.
Mm-hmm. So you wrote three novels and then another iteration. You decided to study family therapy. So you did a master's in family therapy.
Yes.
After your third novel.
Yes.
Can you talk about that threshold?
Well, that was a sort of a coming together of two things as well. I think after the third novel, I wasn't sure that I would write another novel. I actually went through a little bit of a review of novel writing, and I wasn't sure I'd write again. And I was also working in mental health, and I was working with young people, and I realized that to work with young people, I needed to know how to work with a family.
Yeah.
And so I didn't have a novel on the go, so I just thought, I'll just find out about family work, family therapy. And before I knew it, I'd enrolled in a master's of family therapy. And it was an amazing experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was actually while doing that master's that the spark returned, and I thought, this is such an interesting area, and I really feel that you could write about this in a fictional way.
Yeah.
And that was when I decided I would do it.
Write
again. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I think I found the interest for myself, which is what you need ultimately. You need to find the interest to do it, yeah.
So I feel like I was wondering, I'm not sure if it is the case, that the writing life sort of oriented you towards family therapy. I feel that's what you're saying. Like it was a sort of you felt there were no novels kind of, asking to be written.
Mm.
The working life as a GP was sort of opening up to this new possibility. But for me, as a reader of your work, it seems like a really obvious place for you to go. I feel like, yes, of course she studied family therapy, because the writing itself is kind of always oriented in that direction. I mean, you write about the family crucible so well.
Well, yes, I suppose that's a good way of looking at it, in that maybe I needed to study family therapy in order to write the next book. You know, I might have thought that I wasn't able to write another book, or I didn't want to, but maybe it was, I was just waiting for the right, as you say, the right sort of thing to open up for me, or the right idea to actually come along. So yeah, it's totally possible. And I think families are just, yeah, I guess I'll always write about families. I mean, in my book I'm writing now, I'm writing very much about a family relationship. Mm-hmm. So they are endlessly fascinating and rich. And yeah, I will probably keep doing that. Yeah.
So which brings us to your fourth novel, Resistance. And I feel that, I mean, one of the things I'd love to talk to you about is the many ways that we can think about and understand that term, resistance.
Yeah.
And for you, primarily, if it's possible, or just what is the salient understanding of resistance for you in relation to the novel, or just in relation to today?
Yeah. In relation to today?
Well, at any point. Like,
oh, okay.
It doesn't have to necessarily reflect on what's in the novel, but it's such a rich word.
It is a rich word, yeah.
So what I guess what I'm saying is that I don't want to pin you down.
Yeah, okay. Well, I guess the most pertinent thing to say would be that there is a sort of a psychological term or a therapeutic term, a resistance. In that context, it means when the therapy gets a bit stuck, there can be a sense that the client is somehow, there's something sticking them and they can't move forward in the therapy, and they can't, they are resistant in some way to the work that's being done with the therapist. My sense is that in family therapy, that's not a word that people like to use that often, but it is a term that's out there.
I think that it's rendered in the novel. I mean, I think the relationship between Claude, the father of the family who are mandated to see the central character, Nina.
Yeah.
His resistance is like the kind of a hard nub of the story.
Yes. But as I wrote the novel, although I had originally thought of the title Resistance in terms of that therapeutic resistance, but as I wrote the novel and we follow Claude and his family through the novel, I actually thought of resistance, I started to think of it in a different way.
Oh, how so?
So I started to think of it in an honourable, proud way. So one might think of the French Resistance that sort of idea that something oppressive is happening, but we are going to stand up and sort of fight against it not in an aggressive way, but in a sense of withholding or putting up a barrier.
So it's kind of allied to integrity in a way.
Yes. And I do think...
You do feel that.
Yeah, I feel that about the family. I don't know how much we can say, but in terms of what we understand about Claude's background and some of his extended family issues, there is a sense of him and his partner, Lisa, sort of standing up and being quiet and resisting... resisting things, let's say, in a sort of realistic, maybe a sort of a colonial oppression. They're resisting it in some way.
And that sort of the imposition of that narrative, even sort of in specific terms, according to what they had done, like the way it was read through the courts and the way it could be understood once you spend time with the family in the room.
Yes.
You're referring to the French Resistance. Maybe I was thinking about other forms of resistance, and Viktor Frankl talks about resistance as a means of surviving. It's a means of surviving distressing and difficult psychological events.
Yeah.
And the people that he felt were best able to do that had a rich inner life, or they had their eye on a goal. And the third thing that he talked about was that they had the freedom to choose.
Mm.
So
that's brilliant. I love that. I mean, I didn't know that.
Mm.
But yet all those things, I think, apply to the characters of Claude and Lisa, that they do have a rich inner life, which they choose not to share. And they do have goals. And they do have, in a way, an ability to choose.
It's an interesting experience for the reader, because you're wanting the kind of, from Nina's perspective, although I'm not sure she's so invested in this outcome as perhaps I was reading, you want that nut to be cracked. But on the other side, you don't.
Mm.
You want the integrity to hold.
Mm.
And so we have this other relationship in the novel, which is her relationship with her supervisor, which is like a therapeutic relationship with Erin. And I felt that her resistance to Erin was another form of resistance. Mm. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I think, she, just to sort of, by way of sort of filling people in, Nina is the main character, and she's seeing this mandated family who don't want to give much away, and so she thinks she needs help with this case. So she goes to see Erin, who's her supervising therapist, which is quite a common thing for therapists to do, to have a therapist supervising them. And she thinks that she will be talking about this family, just about the family, but Erin starts to probe into Nina's private life, and Nina is resistant to that. And that, I think that's a lot about her not wanting to be vulnerable, I think, and not having, she is the therapist. She doesn't want to be the client, you know, and she doesn't want to show some of the, her pain, her inner pain.
Mm.
Things progress.
They do. So I said in the introduction that there are these seemingly random stories, and I think it's a real achievement of the book that the stories do feel so random, because this is a piece of art. They're not random. These are stories that you've fashioned, placed. In fact, it reminds me a bit of a set list, you know, like which song comes next,
yeah,
and why. And there's always a reason, and it's not haphazard. So there's those stories, but there's also the stories that the buildings speak in your novel. And the story told by the building that the clinic is in is a fascinating story.
Yeah.
It reaches directly into Claude's experience.
Yes.
I'm curious about that from a writerly technique point of view, about how that came to be, but also your use of cultural... a building's not an artifact, but you know, cultural artifacts to bring in that sort of macro level storytelling that we're kind of constantly in.
It's so hard to think back as to how these things happen, because you write a novel over years in my case, and I think it's. I guess you as a writer you have to be aware that you've got to have a sense of place in some instances, not always, but in some instances. And I was thinking about where Nina worked, and I would have just jumped on Google and found out about a place that had been as in Nina's building, had been a receiving home for pregnant women in the early part of the 20th century. And that was very intriguing, because it actually did end up tying into Claude's story, the father in the mandated family story. But also it enabled me to think about what the building had seen, what had happened in the building. Mm-hmm. And there is a little... a section where Nina said that all therapists sort of are haunted by the ghosts of generations past, and because of what people, what families carry in their own histories, but also this building particularly, she felt was haunted by the babies that had lived there and the mothers who had had to give their babies up. And there was a lot of sadness in the walls, I think she said something like that. So that building actually did end up being quite relevant. And I guess there were, I mean, I don't know if we want to keep talking about buildings, but there was another building that was relevant too, was Erin's rooms, her therapy rooms, which were set in a sort of a middle class, very leafy suburb. And that had certain sort of echoes of sadness for Nina to go to that building, because it sort of conjured up a sense of what might have been when she was growing up, but actually what wasn't.
Yeah.
She had an she felt a sense of loss about that. And then, of course, as she talks to Erin, that becomes more and more explained.
Yeah. So we've talked a bit about, you know, the ways of considering resistance, and also the influences of family therapy, the way family therapy has inspired you to write this novel, and that you presume you sort of drew on your experiences. I was just wondering if there are other domains of knowledge that you draw on, there are any particular therapists or modalities that you find really useful or valuable for their explanatory power.
In terms of writing?
Well, actually, either. As I stumbled through that question, I really thought I'd love to know both, either in terms of their... But I don't separate the two, because they're so closely aligned. What things that you think, that's a really powerful explanation for the way human beings behave more generally, or that is a really, would be really pertinent to this novel that I'm writing.
I suppose the one that springs most to mind is the form of therapy that's called narrative therapy, which is a therapy that can be done in an individual context, but it can also be done in a family context, in a systemic context, which means that you're thinking about relationships. You're thinking about the person in relation to someone else rather than a sort of a siloed individual. That's systemic. That's what systemic therapy is.
Is it systemic is siloed?
No.
Opposite.
So individual is more like you just sort of looking at the individual and their psyche. But what family therapists call themselves systemic therapists. So this is an idea that they're looking at a person in the context of their system, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
So their family, often their family, but sometimes it can even be their community. It sort of depends how you practice. But there is this form of therapy called narrative therapy, which, as I say, can sort of be used individually but also systemically. And I think that is hugely relevant to the writing of novels, but particularly to the writing of resistance. And in fact, the prologue, when I wrote the prologue, which... it's just a few paragraphs long, but I really had the idea of narrative therapy in mind. It's basically an explanation of narrative therapy. But the idea of narrative therapy is that people create a narrative of their own life, and they thicken the narrative. So they look for things that fit into that narrative to make that narrative more solid. And the things that don't fit into the narrative, they tend to discard. And often the narrative can be unhelpful. So these are people that are struggling, who are coming to therapy. They have an unhelpful narrative of themselves. And so using narrative therapy, the idea is that you try to make them see that there are other possibilities of their narrative, other ways of looking at things. And it can be a very effective and very powerful therapy. But I sort of do think that in some ways, you know, when you're writing a character in a novel, you sort of always got that lens a little bit, that people see things and they interpret them in a certain way. And Whereas there are a lot of other interpretations.
Yeah. We get we become too adept at sort of interpreting one way, looking through one set of lenses, and to our detriment, because it becomes limiting. I can really see how doing family therapy would be a wonderful kind of stimulus for a writer, a practicing writer, and I'm surprised that there aren't more family therapists and therapists generally who write novels. It seems to be like an almost if-then relationship between the two.
Well, I would think that probably we don't have time.
That's probably one of the main reasons.
But
we're overlooking one aspect of your writing, which I do want to mention, which is the you are a very fine craftsperson. So your writing is very the imagery is really beautifully chosen and quite poetic, and it doesn't clutter up the page, the prose. You don't feel like you're wading through lots and lots of imagery, but the way you describe things is has a lovely sort of, it's specific and quite delicate and lovely to read.
Thank you.
I mean, that you're not going to learn that in the family therapy course.
Well, I so appreciate that. If anyone says poetic, I'm
where do I sign?
I'm absolutely glowing with happiness, because I do want the writing to feel, poetic and elegant, and that's important to me. Mm. So thank you, I appreciate that a lot.
And I'm kicking myself for not having a ready-to-hand example, but there you go. So maybe we could talk a little bit now about your reading. And what you're reading at the moment.
Okay, all right. Well, I am halfway through a novel by Gregory Day, who is a Surf Coast-based writer.
Mm-hmm.
And his book is called, this is his latest book called The Bell of the World, which is a very intriguing title.
Mm.
And it is a book, it is really an ode to nature, and it's quite a transcendent book in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And then he has a central character, Sarah, who's sort of early 20th century character, who is sort of a misfit in lots of ways, but finds her place in the bush, in a sort of a landscape that's not unlike where the author Gregory lives.
Uh-huh.
It really is an ode to nature, and the prose is really quite unusual.
Yeah.
And sometimes very, very beautiful. And it's really about that transcendence in nature. So sort of I haven't read Thoreau,
mm-hmm.
but I imagine that's a little bit like, it's a bit like Thoreau, I would imagine. And it's a really intriguing book.
And can I just say, I'm sorry that I put you right on the spot then. I probably should have asked more generally, like any books that you've read recently that you recommend. So thank you for just jumping in with that one.
That certainly came to mind.
Yeah.
And I read Jessica Ahle's book, Cold Enough for Snow,
mm-hmm.
which was very exquisitely written and very beautiful. And, readers might know of it, set a small novel set in Japan, relationship between a mother and a daughter, and very, very cleverly set in Japan,
mm.
because the writing really mirrors the Japanese aesthetic of restraint and small things and things beautifully and perfectly presented, and it's delicate. It's really, it really mirrors that whole Japanese that Japanese feel. So it's a very beautiful book.
Okay.
Yeah.
And is there a book or an author who's had a significant impact on your development as a writer?
Well, different people at different times.
Yeah.
Most recently, I would have to say Rachel Cusk, and I have said that. So her Outline trilogy was hugely influential in this book. And in fact, I had started the novel, knew that I was really not there, hadn't hit the nail on the head with the voice. And when I picked up Outline, that was the first novel in her trilogy, and started to read that, the penny dropped, and I realised, I could write my novel using this form. And so, yeah, I borrowed the form, and I admit I have changed the form, obviously, haven't slavishly copied it, but the form, you know, the form is really important in terms of content and what goes with what, and the form she used in that book, in that trilogy, has worked well for me to actually express the sort of things that I wanted to express in this book.
And I do feel I can see the connection, and I feel that the especially around, you know, talking about your book in terms of plot, I sort of feel like the best metaphor for the plot is like a net, and the net captures these different fish, you know, which are the stories. And so it's kind of like a distributed plot across the grid of a network, as opposed to a more cause and effect, which you have used in earlier novels. I mean, from that point of view, Resistance is a departure, and I can see why that form would suit this particular exploration so well, because it does.
Well, I mean, I like that idea of the net, Barbara, and I sort of feel like, yes, I can see a net that I've cast widely and pulling in all these different stories, but almost as I pull the net in, sure, things become a little bit more tightened and slightly more cohesive. So you sort of get a sense of why the stories are there. There's a sense of the ending of what they all share in common.
Yes.
So I really like that analogy. That's fantastic.
Well, that could be a good place to draw this conversation to a close, Jacinta.
Of course.
I wanted to just say that one step further from that understanding of the form of the novel, because of its tangential structure, Resistance is a book that is hard to describe, I feel. And for me, in some ways, even hard to remember, like the specifics, because there's no explicit causal relationship between who said what to whom and whose story was that. But I think for the reader, it's a great experience to sort of overcome that slight feeling of disorientation, because the reading experience of Resistance stays with you, because the ideas that emerge are so finely etched and deeply intriguing. So thank you, Jacinta.
Thank you, Barbara. It's been really lovely to talk to you, and we've touched on some things that I'm going to go away and think about.
Well, me too. And thank you very much.